About 20 years ago, a world-renowned scholar from the Jewish tradition, a man called Pinchas Lapid, who was a historian, had written a number of books that were fairly unflattering about Christianity's involvement with the Nazis, came out with a book that caused a huge ruckus, particularly in his own community, the Orthodox Jewish community. It was called The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective. And what he'd done was he'd taken his historical skills, which were huge, and as an older man actually looked at the evidence regarding the resurrection of Jesus, and came up with comments like this. You can see why this would have caused some excitement. This magnificent Jewish professor of history writes this. He said, "I accept the resurrection of Easter Sunday not as an invention of the community of disciples, but as an historical event." Now you can see where that might have caused some excitement. Christians, of course, very pleased. The Orthodox community and the Jewish community, even the liberal community, quite concerned that one of their best scholars... Now, he never became a Christian. One of the interesting things in that book, it's rare to read a novel idea, but his rationale for not becoming a Christian, I remember thinking, I have never heard an argument like this. He's very clever. I don't agree with it. But the reason I mention it to you is this. It's not that Pinchas Lapid looked at the evidence and got convinced, therefore you should believe it too. That would be silly. But I think it is to say that I just picked him as one example of quite a history of eminent men. I'm sure they're eminent women, but I'm just not aware of them, who have come from a deeply sceptical position, who when they have taken their brains and looked at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, have been reluctantly persuaded. There is a number of those. But Pinchas Lapid is one of the most interesting because he comes not just from an atheist position or an agnostic position, but from someone for whom everything about his tradition would be completely hostile to the idea. And one of the things that concerns me about some of my dear friends who aren't Christians is the ease with which they dismiss the resurrection, which I think is a cultural thing, or perhaps a prejudice. And I've said this to them. I said, look, it's just not that easy. Far greater minds than you and I have looked at this and found it very persuasive. It just shows a lack of, I think, awareness of the power of the arguments that have persuaded men like Pinchas Lapid and others that this is not just an invention of the early church, but as he says, it is an historical event. Because one of the things that I think few people in our country seem to get, and perhaps even some Christians don't get yet, is that Christianity in its truest sense, its classical sense, its historical sense, is not views, but news. You've probably heard that before. Christianity is not views about God and about life and ethics. It's not that at all. At its heart is news. So go back and look at the book of Acts, written by Luke, who's highly regarded in the sort of classical history departments for his accuracy and details. He will say a number of times you get to the earliest bits of Christian communication, particularly as they've done in Jerusalem, the city where Jesus died, was buried, and then what? And one of the sort of structures you see in a number of their messages is this, speaking to the people who had Jesus put to death, it's no wonder they were soon being put to death. You crucified him, God raised him, we are witnesses. And in various of their earliest bits of communication, that's the threesome you'll see. They'll talk about Jesus, then they'll say, you crucified him. Sometimes they'll say things like, you crucified the Prince of Life. God raised him, indicating that they have made some sort of a mistake when they decided that Jesus was worthy of execution, that God sort of said, it's like going to the High Court and being overturned. You crucified him, God raised him, we are witnesses. They're not talking about views about God. Now we can rest easily on our death pillow because now we have a sense of life after death. That's rubbish. That's not what Christianity is on about. That may be a fruit that some people get from it, but the tree is not that at all. It's not views, but news. Now, the heading here is whether or not this is sort of wishful thinking. And the idea of wishful thinking normally is there's something that isn't true, but you wish it was true, so you pretend it is true. It's normally a thing that we wouldn't say about ourselves, except looking back and gee, that was wishful thinking, wasn't it? You know, I keep wishing that Souths will win, and I've been living with disappointment, I think it's since 1972, but at least we've got a team now. We lost that for some time. Wishful thinking is when something that you'd like to be true but isn't true, you try to believe it is true. And it's normally about the future. You see, this is just not appropriate to anyone who knows anything about the early centuries of Christianity. Let me draw your attention to a few things. So the notion that Jesus rose from the dead, this was nothing like wishful thinking. So all the early Christians were Jews. And I think a lot of people living now have trouble thinking about this with any sort of historical realism. They were Jews. They weren't pagans, fiercely believing in God the Creator, that there was only one God. He'd spoken very clearly. It was impossible to have a resurrection this side of the judgment day. If anyone said to you, a man has been raised from the dead, not resuscitated, that happens in every culture, you get lucky. You nearly die. But someone who's really and truly dead rises again to triumph over death. Some of the Jews, not most of them, but some of them believed that that would happen on the judgment day. It does not happen in history. It's a nonsense. It's just to confuse the timing. So there's no sense in which the Jews longed for resurrection and therefore projected it onto Jesus. That's just silly. They didn't. The Greeks, the Greek culture into which Christianity soon moved, they despised the notion of resurrection. So in sort of the high court of both philosophy and law in the middle of Athens in the Areopagus, written into the stone are the lines from one of their poets, which are the equivalent of scripture for the Greeks. They didn't quite have scripture, but the poets were taken with great seriousness. Well, these words, it speaks about when a man dies and his blood is poured into the dirt. It calls on the people in the Areopagus to very carefully examine the evidence about how the man dies, because there is no resurrection from the dead. I mean, it's in stone, which makes some sense of the fact when the first Christians were dragged before the Areopagus to explain themselves with this absurd set of beliefs. They listened quite happily to the Greeks as Paul went through about God the Creator and these other things. But when he pronounced that Jesus rose from the dead, they mock. It's a self-evident stupidity. The Greeks don't want to be resurrected from the dead. Most Australians don't. We speak about the release of the spirit from the prison of the body and all that sort of stuff. That's very fine Greek thinking. It's not what Christianity is about. There's something repugnant and repulsive about this obsession with the body coming back. But that's what Christianity is on about. It's not on about the immortality of the soul at all. That's a Greek thing. There may be overlaps with Christianity. But I'm just bringing this to your attention to say, when people speak about it being wishful thinking, it's just not. The Jews had no desire to see anyone walking around who was resurrected this side of the judgment day. The Greeks despised it. And if you hold this view, I want to say this as gently as I can, but still be honest, adult to adult. One of the most common views that gets said to me with patronizing attitude again and again and again is, well, of course, the ancient world was full of these parallels, Osiris, the Egyptian, he rises from the dead. Mithras. I mean, really, people need to get off the internet or books based on the internet and go and read the scholars or go and read the sources. Osiris is not resurrected from the dead. His life endures in the shadowy Egyptian underworld. There's just no parallel between someone who's murdered and butchered, his body is torn apart, buried in a grave, and then walks out, which is what Christianity is saying. You have to believe it, but at least understand the concept. There is no parallel between that and the story of Osiris or Mithras. Most of the evidence, almost all the evidence here about Mithras comes from the 2nd and 3rd century, post-Jesus. And again, it's all in the mythical realm. It's like the rainbow serpent, which I don't say with any disrespect. You don't ask when was the rainbow, give me a date. That's to show you're an ignoramus. Myths don't happen in time and space in history. You can't touch them. It's an ethereal sort of realm. Now, Christianity comes, and there's no sense of wishful thinking because no one wanted this thing. And the early Christians didn't know what to make of it either. They had all sorts of ways that as Jews they could have honoured Jesus. You see, it's not a common thing, the notion of people coming back from the dead. It's a weird thing. See, the Zoroastrians didn't feel they needed to honour their prophet by pretending he rose from the dead. Right? The followers of Muhammad, well, they're not his followers, but people who take him to be the prophet, they didn't feel the need to pretend he conquered death. The Jews felt no need to pretend that Moses conquered death. You can visit many of the burial grounds of the great spiritual leaders. You can't visit the burial site of Buddha because his body was burned and scattered all around Asia. But Buddhists didn't feel the need to pretend that he rose from the dead. They don't want resurrection from the dead. Right? We just sometimes think this is what you do. It's what religious people do. They make up this nonsense. It's not. It's very unique in human history. And one of the questions that people interested in looking at history from history's point of view, not from people 2,000 years later saying, well, of course you'd die to form the world's largest religion. No. The apostles, they had not the faintest clue that this pathetic little oppressed group, you know, was ever going to... I think it would shock them to see how far it's grown. And they'd probably be appalled at a lot of the way Christians have behaved, I would think, like me. Not that I'm appalled with others, I am, but I'm appalled with myself. That's what I'm talking about. Well, look, just before we sort of stop and throw it open for questions, I've got down here the word sex, which is just cheap, really. But the sort of evidence that people notice is this. The S. What starts, you know, the way in which Christianity starts, it explodes out of nowhere with this irrepressible confidence in the face of death, with this message that this crucified criminal was actually the Son of God, with this message that was unheard of someone who had conquered death, gone into the very belly of death and come out. Now, how do you explain that? What is the sort of cause of this extraordinary, unstoppable effect? The world's finest religion on the earth, then, as I would understand it, and certainly the world's most powerful and finest judicial system, tried very hard to crush and destroy, but they were unable to. What starts this peculiar worldwide movement of Jesus? The resurrection. It was always about resurrection. It's in the DNA of Christianity. It might be rubbish, right? But that's what's in the DNA. The E. The E, one of the things that people like Pinkas the Pete have had to try and make sense of is the empty tomb. Right? How does it start, is the S. The E stands for the empty tomb. There's not a... Of all the resurrection scholars, and there are many who are atheists, Jews, agnostics, you know, it's a whole area of professional scholarship, like all sorts of areas. None of them doubt the fact that the tomb was empty on the Sunday. Christianity simply couldn't have started if the body of Jesus was still in the tomb. Because within a few weeks, they're proclaiming, you killed him, God raised him, we saw him. It was a serious matter that they were doing. They were accusing the leaders of God's people of having murdered the Son of God. If the tomb wasn't empty, the whole thing would never have started. The whole movement could have been finished very quickly. The tomb is clearly empty, as you heard in the reading. The women went to finish the burial. They didn't find the body, it says in verse 3. It's missing, much to their angst and surprise. The X part is because I can't spell, because I come from Sydney, a land of convicts, and it stands for experiences. Right? The S is there. What starts this peculiar resurrection movement? The E stands for the empty tomb, which needs explaining. It's a brute fact of history, pretty much. There's experiences. Let me give you a quote from Gerd Ludemann, who's probably one of the world's leading scholars on the resurrection, an atheist. Here's what he says. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. Now, he doesn't think it was Jesus, but he's saying they had an experience. Let me read it again. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. The question is, because they don't just say the tomb's missing, oh, he's risen, any more than you would if you found a body missing. No one goes, missing body, resurrection. Right? The women, as you heard read in verse 11 and 12, they go back to tell the disciples what's happened, the news they've got, and what do the men do? Right? Sexist pigs. They dismiss it as nonsense. Old wives' tales. How can you believe women, for crying out loud? They're so hysterical in the presence of death. So they don't even go to check, except one. One out of the 11 goes to at least have a look. Right? The other 10, it's not even worthy of consideration. Right? Everyone knows when you're dead, and you're a long time dead. But they're the three areas that people who address these questions think, well, okay, what are we to make of this? Is the resurrection something that happened to Jesus? Or is the resurrection something that happened in the disciples? That they were either deceived or they were deceivers. When they say, we saw him. They had some sort of experience. One possibility is that they are liars. That was the explanation given. You know, Christianity, as Hitler and Wagner saw, it was a form of Judaism. It grew out of Judaism. And the official position of mainline Judaism is expressed in Matthew 28 and continued on for a couple of hundred years, that the explanation for Christianity is that the disciples stole the body. Right? That's one possibility, that Christianity is built on a deliberate, cold-blooded lie. But most scholars, most realists, say that doesn't make any sense. Why do people lie? To make some advantage. Within a couple of months, the first of the Christians had been murdered, had been put to death. The leaders were already being whipped and flogged. This is not America, where you can seem to make money with ridiculous religions. Right? There was nothing in it for the early Christians. Most of them got put to death. And yet the interesting thing is, and skeptical scholars are aware of this too, that not one of the early Christians ever broke. The Watergate team of the most powerful men in the world, couldn't keep their lie together for a fortnight before one of them cracked. Right? These guys, there's no hint of them cracking at any point because they didn't. Are they deceivers? Do they have hallucinations? Is that a useful explanation? We can talk about that. You can read about that. The sorts of things, and I know I can see I need to finish, the sorts of things that people have often used to attack the gospel story, because I want to suggest to you this, if you've never just sort of got a Bible out of the library or bought yourself one, look it up on the net. That's the great thing now, isn't it? You don't need to buy one. Just read the four earliest accounts in the Gospels. Matthew's, Mark's, Luke's, John's. Read them. Do these read like the writings of honest men? A number of attacks get made. One of the most interesting, but most of the attacks for historians are actually strength, e.g. this one. There's no actual account of the resurrection. Isn't that weird? Everything in Christianity hangs on the resurrection. But nowhere in the four Gospels is there an account of it. Now, go to the ridiculous Gospels that we hear so much about now, written hundreds of years later, that, you know, scholars think are a joke, but popular literature makes much of. The Gospel of Philip and things like that. They've got what's missing. They've got terrific descriptions of the resurrection of Jesus. You've not just got a few soldiers, you've got all the high priests there as well, because once you start making a mix, you may as well make it great. All his enemies, they're all gathered outside. Down comes two huge angels. They're all struck and run away in terror, right? And they go into the tomb, the description of them bringing Jesus out. The angels' heads reached up to the heaven, but the man they were helping out, his head reached above the heavens. Coming out behind Jesus was the cross that he died on. What's that doing in the tomb? Who knows? But it's a good story, right? The cross comes and God says from heaven to the cross, "Hast thou preached to the souls of those who are in captivity?" "Yea, Lord," answers the cross, "I have," right? The early Christians, the early gods have no account of the resurrection. Why? They didn't see it. They're just telling you what they saw, what they knew. The other thing people say is, where was the tomb? We don't know. You can go to Jerusalem, pay your money, take your pick. That's not a mark of the badness of this. The fact is the early Christians didn't give a damn where he was buried. I can't tell you what floor on that huge hospital my daughters were born in. Like, I was there, it was very important, but frankly, we don't have a shrine there to them. They were there, they're gone. The early Christians, there was no pilgrim, and this is strange. But it points to the fact of the reality of the resurrection. The point that you heard mentioned, who were the first key witnesses? Now, it's hard for us in the 21st century, unless you've got the residual heart of a sexist pig, you might get this, to note the significance. If the early Christians were making this up as a myth, why do all the earlier sources say the key witnesses were women? Now, we don't believe this, none of us, for a second, would we downplay the validity of a woman witness. But in that culture, they most certainly did. Josephus, a great Jewish writer from the time, says this, "From women, let no evidence be accepted because of the levity and temerity of their sex." Now, I don't know what temerity of their sex means, but I don't think it's good. Right? Now, that's not the Christian view, but it was the common view then. I mean, it's a bit like us making up a religion, having at the heart of a ridiculous belief that nobody particularly wants, and making as our key witnesses a used car salesman and a failed politician. Right? It's just a successful politician. Or a successful, thank you, God, mistake. So there's things like that we can miss. Why did they have women as the key? Because they were. It actually weakened the cause. The fact that Jesus sometimes not recognised when he's first met. Why would you believe? Man, if I was writing these things, I could write better gospels than these. Well, I've had experiences of that, where you meet someone not expecting to meet and you don't recognise them. The evidence is very powerful. So what? Muhammad Ali, suffering sadly from Parkinson's disease, but a very, you know, a brilliant boxer and a very clever man. He became a peculiarly American sort of Muslim at one stage, the Nation of Islam. He was interviewed once and he said, Muhammad, if you could be anywhere in history at any time, where and when would you like to be? He said, surprisingly but brilliantly, I'd like to be outside the tomb of Jesus on Easter Sunday morning to see what happened. Because he understood that if someone has actually defeated death, that actually changes everything. The notion of the resurrection is not wishful thinking. Right? It's not a view about life and life after death. It's news. It's either a lie or it's earth-shattering. It's worth having a look at the evidence.
Thanks very much for that, Ian. We're just, if you want to take a moment just to ask a question.
Just a quick query. The Jewish historian that you
Pinchas Lapid, yeah.
You mentioned that he didn't become Christian as a result.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'd be interested to know, did he give any comment as to why?
Yes.
In relation to what he looked at, found to be what he believed to be the view of the fact.
Yeah, that's a good question. It is very rare that you read a brand new idea, and the more you read, the rarer that is. I mean, you get it in science sometimes, when we stumble into quantum mechanics, you know, it's like, well, goodness, what's going on here? But generally speaking, it's just the rehash of old. I mean, it's remarkable how many ideas I hear people give to me now that were really well and truly aired in the 1780s about the resurrection, well and truly tried, like the swoon theory, he didn't die, just, and the hallucination theory. All these things were tried in the 18th century and given up by atheists, by unbelievers. So when I read his I'm thinking, oh, he'll become a Christian, this guy's got him. Most people, once they get a resurrection, they go, my goodness. He brilliantly, but I don't think it's all that good, but it's brilliant nonetheless. He says he needs to stay as a Jew because he says Christianity needs Judaism. He said Christianity has spread the great values of Judaism around the world, monotheism, the belief in mercy and justice, which he sees to be the great... we take those things for granted, but they really do come to us through the Jewish heritage and the Christian heritage. He says, so Christianity has been like the missionary wing of Judaism. But he said it has a danger of falling into tritheism, that instead of believing in one God in three people, that it can fall into three separate gods, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Now, I don't think it does. He says, so Jews need to stay as Jews to give Christianity its anchor. I think you clever monkey. But... Anyhow, that's between him and God.
He didn't
believe he was the Son of God. Now, it was 20 years ago, so I can't remember. Yes, that's a good... Yeah, it's, you can get it through Amazon. It's, you know, it's still around and in many libraries. It's called The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Any other queries or statements or things you heard friends say about the resurrection that you might like to try out? Because I'm aware I've left out a truckload of stuff, even from the notes, but so it's a huge topic. Any queries or statements about this question of wish fulfillment?
Is that perhaps why Jairus' daughter was said to be asleep by Jesus?
Yes, it is interesting, because I mentioned that the Jews did not believe in resurrection up until the end of time, on the judgment day, when, not surprisingly, Islam believes it too, as do Christians. We believe in the general resurrection of all, the resurrection of the dead. Now, I think Jesus, the idea of death as sleep certainly comes into the West, particularly through Christianity. I think the word cemetery is from the Latin word dormitory. The Romans had very little understanding of what happened after death. There was quite a few bits of forlorn poetry. Christianity came saying death has been triumphed over. I think they would have probably... See, the difference between Jairus' daughter, a little girl who dies and Jesus raises her fairly soon. She's freshly dead. She'd still been warm, frankly. He's on his way to her house and he gets the message she's dead. They're really resuscitated. I think they're resuscitation. So she is brought back to the same life as is Lazarus. He raises three or four people from the dead. Whereas Jesus is brought into it, he has conquered death. So as the Bible says, never to die again, whereas Jairus' daughter would have died. But Jesus, people say she's dead. He says, don't fear, she's sleeping. And part of the significance of that is it's quite beautiful. There's some real loveliness in the life of Jesus. There's some tough stuff as well. he says to a little girl, get up, which is exactly the words that a mother would use to wake a daughter up for school or something. Little child, arise. And which is what he's doing. And it's as easy for Jesus to raise the dead as it is for a mother of an obedient daughter. They do exist. Yeah.
What is your view on Jesus' resurrected body? Would that be the same body as in the future when we were resurrected? Because he can still eat the fish.
Yes.
Do certain things.
Yes.
Just interested to hear.
Yeah. What is the nature of Jesus' resurrection? Is it going to be like our resurrection body? It is interesting that Jesus, and I was going to touch, I got a text message from a friend in Sydney who's genuinely on side with Christianity. I'm not sure if he's as clear as I hope he'll get one day, in my opinion. I told him what I was doing today. He said, oh, why do people need evidence? That must make Jesus very cranky. But I think on the contrary, Jesus offers, he says, touch me. I mean, he's not saying, believe. It's not the Richard Dawkins definition of faith that Christians simply don't share, which is believe. And the sillier the belief is, the better the faith. Now, Jesus says, touch me. He's an empiricist. If you need evidence, touch me. Look. And then the thing we know about from the Jewish writings, because there's an enormous amount. The Jews are great writing and reading people, have been for three centuries. We've got lots of writing. We know what the Jews believed in. We'd like to know more, always, but, you know. We know that what they believed about ghosts was that they were real. And two things about ghosts: you can't touch them and they don't eat. My own hunch is that Jesus was enjoying this. His disciples, as you heard it read, they're not believing, but they're so happy to see him, but they cannot believe it. So that's why he says, touch me. I'm not a ghost. They're still not getting it. So he says, you got a fish finger here? I'll eat something. My understanding, 1 Corinthians 15, which is one of the earliest bits of Christian writing, where Paul is writing to the Greeks in Corinth, trying to explain about the body, that it's a real resurrection body, and it will be a body like his, which is touchable, it eats, which is nice, because so many of Jesus' pictures of heaven is this huge banquet, like a wedding banquet. If you've ever been to a happy wedding, a wedding that you're pleased to be at, with friends and good food, and everyone's looking nice, that's what Jesus' heaven's going to be like. It's not sitting around playing, okay, let's sing him 438 again.
Can you promise no cholesterol?
No, what's that?
Cholesterol.
Yeah, eat up, baby. And we won't have any of this nonsense, oh, chocolate's good for you. Gosh, I hate that. Just enjoy it. Now, we will have a body like his. 1 Corinthians 15 says that it'll be different. It's like when a seed falls in the ground and the plant comes out. Directly related, and yet seed's fairly ugly, plant's pretty beautiful.